some fishy's cell, the assumption was that it came in the mail from a friend or relative. Of course, all the care packages from friends and relatives are opened and the contents inventoried, but who goes back and rechecks the inventory sheets for something as harmless as a Rita Hayworth or an Ava Gardner pinup? When you're in a pressure cooker, you learn to live and let live, or somebody will carve you a brand new mouth just above the Adam's apple. You learn to make allowances. It was Ernie again who took the poster up to Andy's cell, 14, from my own, 6. And it was Ernie who brought back the note written in Andy's careful hand. Just one word, thanks. A little while later, as they filed us out for morning chow, I glanced into his cell and saw Rita over his bunk in all her swimsuited glory, one hand behind her head, her eyes half closed, those soft, satiny lips parted. It was over his bunk where he could look at her nights after lights out in the glow of the arc sodiums in the exercise yard. But in the bright morning sunlight, there were dark slashes across her face, the shadow of the bars on his single-slit window. Now I'm going to tell you what happened in mid-May of 1950 that finally ended Andy's 3-year series of skirmishes with the sisters. It was also the incident which eventually got him out of the laundry and into the library, where he filled out his work time until he left our happy little family earlier this year. You may have noticed how much of what I've told you already is hearsay. Someone saw something and told me, and I told you. Well, in some cases I've simplified it even more than it really was, and have repeated or will repeat fourth or fifth-hand information. That's the way it is here. The grapevine is very real, and you have to use it if you're going to stay ahead. Also, of course, you have to know how to pick out the grains of truth from the chaff of lies, rumors, and wish-it-had-beens. You may also have gotten the idea that I'm describing someone who's more legend than man, and I would have to agree that there's some truth to that. To us long-timers who knew Andy over a space of years, there was an element of fantasy to him, a sense almost of myth-magic, if you get what I mean. That story I passed on about Andy refusing to give Boggs Diamond a head job is part of that myth, and how he kept on fighting the sisters is part of it, and how he got the library job is part of it too. But with one important difference. I was there, and I saw what happened, and I swear on my mother's name that it's all true. The oath of a convicted murderer may not be worth much, but believe this, I don't lie. Andy and I were on fair speaking terms by then. The guy fascinated me. Looking back to the poster episode, I see there's one thing I neglected to tell you, and maybe I should. 5 weeks after he hung Rita up, I'd forgotten all about it by then and had gone on to other deals, Ernie passed a small white box through the bars of my cell. "From Dufresne," he said, low, and never missed a stroke with his push broom. "Thanks, Ernie," I said, and slipped him half a pack of Camels. Now, what the hell was this, I was wondering, as I slipped the cover from the box. There was a lot of white cotton inside, and below that, I looked for a long time. For a few minutes, it was like I didn't even dare touch them. They were so pretty. There's a crying shortage of pretty things in the slam, and the real pity of it is that a lot of men don't even seem to miss them. There were 2 pieces of quartz in that box, both of them carefully polished. They had been chipped into driftwood shapes. There were little sparkles of iron pyrites in them, like flecks of gold. If they hadn't been so heavy, they would have served as a fine pair of men's cufflinks. They were that close to being a matched set. How much work went into creating those 2 pieces? Hours and hours after lights out, I knew that. First the chipping and shaping, and then the almost endless polishing and finishing with those rock blankets. Looking at them, I felt the warmth that any man or woman feels when he or she is looking at something pretty, something that has been worked and made. That's the thing that really separates us from the animals, I think. And I felt something else, too, a sense of awe for the man's brute persistence. but I never knew just how persistent Andy Dufresne could be until much later. In May of 1950, the powers that be decided that the roof of the license plate factory ought to be resurfaced with roofing tar. They wanted it done before it got too hot up there, and they asked for volunteers to do the work, which was planned to take about a week. More than 70 men spoke up because it was outside work, and May is one damn fine month for outside work. 9 or 10 names were drawn out of a hat, and 2 of them happened to be Andy's and my own. For the next week, we'd be marched out to the exercise yard after breakfast, with 2 guards up front and 2 more behind, plus all the guards in the towers keeping a weather eye on the proceedings through their field glasses for good measure. 4 of us would be carrying a big extension ladder on these morning marches. I always got a kick out of the way Dickie Betts, who was on that job, called that sort of ladder an extensible, and we'd put it up against the side of that low, flat building. Then we'd start bucket brigading hot buckets of tar up to the roof. Spill that shit on you and you'd jitterbug all the way to the infirmary. There were 6 guards on the project, all of them picked on the basis of seniority. It was almost as good as a week's vacation, because instead of sweating it out in the laundry or the plate shop or standing over a bunch of cons cutting pulp or brush somewhere out in the willy-wags, they were having a regular May holiday in the sun, just sitting there with their backs up against the low parapet, shooting the bull back and forth. They didn't even have to keep more than half an eye on us, because the south wall sentry post was close enough so that the fellows up there could have spit their chews on us if they'd wanted to. If anyone on the roof-ceiling party had made one funny move, it would take 4 seconds to cut him smack in 2 with 45 caliber machine gun bullets. So those screws just sat there and took their ease. All they needed was a couple of 6-packs buried in crushed ice, and they would have been the lords of all creation. One of them was a fellow named Byron Hadley, and in that year of 1950 he'd been at Shawshank longer than I had, longer than the last 2 wardens put together, as a matter of fact. The fellow running the show in 1950 was a prissy-looking down-east Yankee named George Dunahy. He had a degree in penal administration. No one liked him, as far as I could tell, except the people who had gotten him his appointment. I heard that he was only interested in 3 things: compiling statistics for a book, which was later published by a small New England outfit called Lightside Press, where he probably had to pay to have it done; which team won the intramural baseball championship each September; and getting a death penalty law passed in Maine. A regular bear for the death penalty was George Dunahy. He was fired off the job in 1953 when it came out he was running a discount auto repair service down in the prison garage and splitting the profits with Byron Hadley and Greg Stammers. Hadley and Stammers came out of that one okay. They were old hands at keeping their asses covered. But Dunahy took a walk. No one was sorry to see him go, but nobody was exactly pleased to see Greg Stammers step into his shoes either. He was a short man with a tight, hard gut, and the coldest brown eyes you ever saw. He always had a painful, pursed little grin on his face, as if he had to go to the bathroom and couldn't quite manage it. During Stammers' tenure as warden, there was a lot of brutality at Shawshank, and although I have no proof, I believe there were maybe 6 moonlight burials in the stand of scrub forest that lies east of the prison. Dunahy was bad, but Greg Stammers was a cruel, wretched, cold-hearted man. He and Byron Hadley were good friends. As warden, George Dunahy was nothing but a posturing figurehead. It was Stammers, and through him Hadley, who actually administered the prison. Hadley was a tall, shambling man with thinning red hair. He sunburned easily, and he talked loud, and if you didn't move fast enough to suit him, he'd clout you with his stick. On that day, our third on the roof, he was talking to another guard named Mert Entwistle. Hadley had gotten some amazingly good news, so he was griping about it. That was his style. He was a thankless man with not a good word for anyone, a man who was convinced that the whole world was against him. The world had cheated him out of the best years of his life, and the world would be more than happy to cheat him out of the rest. I have seen some screws that I thought were almost saintly, and I think I know why that happens. They are able to see the difference between their own lives, poor and struggling as they might be, and the lives of the men they are paid by the state to watch over. These guards are able to formulate a comparison concerning pain. Others can't or won't. For Byron Hadley, there was no basis of comparison. He could sit there, cool and at his ease under the warm May sun, and find the gall to mourn his own good luck, while less than 10 feet away a bunch of men were working and sweating and burning their hands on great big buckets filled with bubbling tar, men who had to work so hard in their ordinary round of days that this looked like a respite. You may remember the old question, the one that's supposed to define your outlook on life when you answer it. For Byron Hadley, the answer would always be half empty. The glass is half empty, forever and ever, amen. If you gave him a cool drink of apple cider, he'd think about vinegar. If you told him his wife had always been faithful to him, he'd tell you it was because she was so damn ugly. So there he sat, talking to Mert Entwistle loud enough for all of us to hear, his broad white forehead already starting to redden with the sun. He had one hand thrown back over the low parapet surrounding the roof. The other was on the butt of his .38. We all got the story. Along with Mert, it seemed that Hadley's older brother had gone off to Texas some 14 years ago, and the rest of the family hadn't heard from the son of a bitch since. They had all assumed he was dead and good riddance. Then, a week and a half ago, a lawyer had called them long distance from Austin. It seemed that Hadley's brother had died 4 months ago, and a rich man at that. "It's frigging incredible how lucky some assholes can get," this paragon of gratitude on the plate shop roof said. The money had come as a result of oil and oil leases, and there was close to $1 million. No, Hadley wasn't a millionaire. That might have made him even happy, at least for a while. But the brother had left a pretty damn decent bequest of $35,000 to each surviving member of his family back in Maine, if they could be found. Not bad. Like getting lucky and winning a sweepstakes. But to Byron Hadley, the glass was always half empty. He spent most of the morning bitching to Mert about the bite that the goddamn government was going to take out of his windfall. "They'll leave me about enough to buy a new car with," he allowed. "And then what happens? You have to pay the damn taxes on the car and the repairs and maintenance. You got your goddamn kids pestering you to take them for a ride with the top down." "And to drive it if they're old enough," Mert said. Old Mert Entwistle knew which side his bread was buttered on, and he didn't say what must have been as obvious to him as to the rest of us. "If that money's worrying you so bad, Byron, old kid, old sock, I'll just take it off your hands. After all, what are friends for?" "That's right. Wanting to drive it, wanting to learn to drive on it, for Christ's sake," Byron said with a shudder. "Then what happens at the end of the year? If you figured the tax wrong and you don't have enough left over to pay the overdraft, you got to pay out of your own pocket or maybe even borrow it from one of those kikey loan agencies. And they audit you anyway, you know, it don't matter. And when the government audits you, they always take more. Who can fight Uncle Sam? He puts his hand inside your shirt and squeezes your tit until it's purple and you end up getting the short end. Christ!" He lapsed into a morose silence, thinking of what terrible bad luck he'd had to inherit that $35,000. Andy Dufresne had been spreading tar with a big pad brush less than 15 feet away, and now he tossed it into his pail and walked over to where Mert and Hadley were sitting. We all tightened up, and I saw one of the other screws, Tim Youngblood, drag his hand down to where his pistol was holstered. One of the fellows in the sentry tower struck his partner on the arm, and they both turned too. For one moment I thought Andy was going to get shot or clubbed or both. Then he said very softly to Hadley, "Do you trust your wife?" Hadley just stared at him. He was starting to get red in the face, and I knew that was a bad sign. In about 3 seconds he was going to pull his billy and give Andy the butt end of it right in the solar plexus where that big bundle of nerves is. A hard enough hit there can kill you, but they always go for it. If it doesn't kill you, it'll paralyze you long enough to forget whatever cute move it was that you had planned. "Boy," Hadley said, "I'll give you just one chance to pick up that pad, and then you're going off this roof on your head." Andy just looked at him, very calm and still. His eyes were like ice. It was as if he hadn't heard. And I found myself wanting to tell him how it was, to give him the crash course. The crash course is you never let on that you hear the guards talking. You never try to horn in on their conversation unless you're asked, and then you always tell them just what they want to hear and shut up again. Black man, white man, red man, yellow man, in prison it doesn't matter, because we've got our own brand of equality. In prison every con's a nigger, and you have to get used to the idea if you intend to survive men like Hadley and Greg Stamos, who really would kill you as soon as look at you. When you're in stir, you belong to the state, and if you forget it, woe is you. I've known men who've lost eyes, men who've lost toes and fingers. I knew one man who lost the tip of his penis and counted himself lucky that was all he lost. I wanted to tell Andy that it was already too late. He could go back and pick up his brush, and there would still be some big lug waiting for him in the showers that night, ready to Charlie horse both of his legs and leave him writhing on the cement. You could buy a lug like that for a pack of cigarettes or three Baby Ruths. Most of all, I wanted to tell him not to make it any worse than it already was. What I did was to keep on running tar out onto the roof as if nothing at all was happening. Like everyone else, I look after my own ass first. I have to. It's cracked already. And in Shawshank, there have always been Hadleys willing to finish the job of breaking it. Andy said, "Maybe I put it wrong." Whether you trust her or not is immaterial. The problem is whether or not you believe she would ever go behind your back, try to hamstring you. Hadley got up. Mert got up. Tim Youngblood got up. Hadley's face was as red as the side of a fire barn. "Your only problem," he said, "is going to be how many bones you still got unbroken. You can count them in the infirmary. Come on, Mert, we're throwing this sucker over the side." Tim Youngblood drew his gun. The rest of us kept tarring like mad. The sun beat down. They were going to do it. Hadley and Mert were simply going to pitch him over the side. Terrible accident. Dufresne, prisoner 81433-SHNK, was taking a couple of empties down and slipped on the ladder. Too bad. They laid hold of him. Mert on the right arm, Hadley on the left. And he didn't resist. His eyes never left Hadley's red, horsey face. "If you've got your thumb on her, Mr. Hadley," he said in that same calm, composed voice, "there's not a reason why you shouldn't have every cent of that money. Final score, Mr. Byron Hadley, $35,000. Uncle Sam, zip." Mert started to drag him toward the edge. Hadley just stood there. For a moment, Andy was like a rope between them in a tug-of-war game. Then Hadley said, "Hold on one second, Mert. What do you mean, boy?" "I mean, if you've got your thumb on your wife, you can give it to her," Andy said. "You better start making sense, boy, or you're going over." "The IRS allows you a one-time-only gift to your spouse," Andy said. "It's good up to $60,000. Hadley was now looking at Andy as if he had been pole-axed. "No, that ain't right," he said. "Tax-free?" "Tax-free," Andy said. "IRS can't touch one cent." "How would you know a thing like that?" Tim Youngblood said, "He used to be a banker, Byron. I suppose he might..." "Shut your head, Trout," Hadley said without looking at him. Tim Youngblood flushed and shut up. Some of the guards called him Trout because of his thick lips and buggy eyes. Hadley kept looking at Andy. "You're the smart banker who shot his wife. Why should I believe a smart banker like you? So I can wind up in here breaking rocks right alongside you? You'd like that, wouldn't you?" Andy said quietly, "If you went to jail for tax evasion, you'd go to a federal penitentiary, not Shawshank. But you won't. The tax-free gift to the spouse is a perfectly legal loophole. The tax-free gift to the spouse is a perfectly legal loophole. I've done dozens, no, hundreds of them. It's meant primarily for people with small businesses to pass on, for people who come into one-time-only windfalls, like yourself." "I think you're lying," Hadley said, but he didn't. You could see he didn't. There was an emotion dawning on his face, something that was grotesque overlying that long, ugly countenance and that receding, sunburned brow, an almost obscene emotion when seen on the features of Byron Hadley. It was hope. "No, I'm not lying. There's no reason why you should take my word for it, either. Engage a lawyer, ambulance-chasing, highway-robbing cocksuckers," Hadley cried. Andy shrugged. "Then go to the IRS. They'll tell you the same thing for free." Actually, you don't need me to tell you at all. You could have investigated the matter for yourself.
You're fucking A. I don't need any smart, wife-killing banker to show me where the bear shit in the buckwheat.
You'll need a tax lawyer or a banker to set up the gift for you, and that'll cost you something, Andy said.
Or, if you were interested, I'd be glad to set it up for you, nearly free of charge. The price would be 3 beers apiece for my co-workers.
Co-workers, Mert said, and let out a rusty guffaw. He slapped his knee. A real knee-slapper was old Mert, and I hope he died of intestinal cancer in a part of the world where morphine is as of yet undiscovered.
Co-workers ain't that cute. Co-workers, you ain't got any...
Shut your friggin' trap, Hadley growled, and Mert shut. Hadley looked at Andy again.
What was you saying?
I was saying that I'd only ask 3 beers apiece for my co-workers, if that seems fair, Andy said. I think a man feels more like a man when he's working out of doors in the springtime if he can have a bottle of suds. That's only my opinion. It would go down smooth, and I'm sure you'd have their gratitude.
I have talked to some of the other men who were up there that day. Rennie Martin, Logan St. Pierre, and Paul Bonsant were 3 of them, and we all saw the same thing then, felt the same thing. Suddenly it was Andy who had the upper hand. It was Hadley who had the gun on his hip, and the billy in his hand. Hadley who had his friend Greg Stamos behind him, and the whole prison administration behind Stamos, the whole power of the state behind that. But all at once, in that golden sunshine, it didn't matter. And I felt my heart leap up in my chest as it never had since the truck drove me and 4 others through the gate back in 1938 and I stepped out onto the exercise yard. Andy was looking at Hadley with those cold, clear, calm eyes. And it wasn't just the $35,000 then, we all agreed on that. I've played it over and over in my mind, and I know it was man against man. And Andy simply forced him, the way a strong man can force a weaker man's wrist to the table in a game of Indian wrestling. There was no reason, you see, why Hadley couldn't have given Mert the nod at that very minute, pitched Andy overside onto his head, and still taken Andy's advice. No reason. But he didn't.
"I could get you all a couple of beers if I wanted to," Hadley said. "A beer does taste good while you're working." The colossal prick even managed to sound magnanimous.
"I'd just give you one piece of advice the IRS wouldn't bother with," Andy said. His eyes were fixed unwinkingly on Hadley's. "Make this gift to your wife if you're sure. If you think there's even a chance she might double-cross you or backshoot you, we could work out something else."
"Double-cross me?" Hadley asked harshly. "Double-cross me? Mr. Hotshot Banker, if she ate her way through a boxcar of Ex-Lax, she wouldn't dare fart unless I gave her the nod."
Mert, Youngblood, and the other screws yucked it up dutifully. Andy never cracked a smile.
"I'll write down the forms you need," he said. "You can get them at the post office, and I'll fill them out for your signature."
That sounded suitably important, and Hadley's chest swelled. Then he glared around at the rest of us and hollered, "What are you Jimmies staring at? Move your asses, goddammit!" He looked back at Andy. "You come over here with me, Hotshot, and listen to me well. If you're Jewing me somehow, you're going to find yourself chasing your own head around Shower Sea before the week's out."
"Yes, I understand that," Andy said softly. And he did understand it. The way it turned out, he understood a lot more than I did. More than any of us did. That's how, on the second to last day of the job, the convict crew that tarred the plate factory roof in 1950 ended up sitting in a row at 10 o'clock on a spring morning, drinking black label beer supplied by the hardest screw that ever walked a turn at Shawshank State Prison. That beer was piss warm, but it was still the best I ever had in my life. We sat and drank it and felt the sun on our shoulders, and not even the expression of half amusement, half contempt on Hadley's face, as if he were watching apes drink beer instead of men, could spoil it. It lasted 20 minutes, that beer break, and for those 20 minutes we felt like free men. We could have been drinking beer and tarring the roof of one of our own houses. Only Andy didn't drink.
I already told you about his drinking habit. He sat hunkered down in the shade, hands dangling between his knees, watching us and smiling a little. It's amazing how many men remember him that way, and amazing how many men were on that work crew when Andy Dufresne faced down Byron Hadley. I thought there were 9 or 10 of us, but by 1955 there must have been 200 of us. Maybe more, if you believed what you heard. So, yeah, if you ask me to give you a flat-out answer to the question of whether I'm trying to tell you about a man or a legend that got made up around the man, like a pearl around a little piece of grit, I'd have to say that the answer lies somewhere in between. All I know for sure is that Andy Dufresne wasn't much like me or anyone else I ever knew since I came inside. He brought in $500 jammed up his back porch, but somehow that gray-meat son of a bitch managed to bring in something else as well. A sense of his own worth, maybe, or a feeling that he could be the winner in the end. Or maybe it was only a sense of freedom, even inside these goddamned gray walls. It was a kind of inner light he carried around with him. I only knew him to lose that light once, and that is also a part of this story.
This ends Side 2 of Cassette 1.
By World Series time of 1950, this was the year the Philadelphia Whiz Kids dropped 4 straight, you will remember, Andy was having no more trouble from the sisters. Stamos and Hadley had passed the word. If Andy Dufresne came to either of them, or any of the other screws that formed a part of their coterie and showed so much as a single drop of blood in his underpants, every sister in Shawshank would go to bed that night with a headache. They didn't fight it. As I've pointed out, there was always an 18-year-old car thief, or a fire bug, or some guy who'd gotten his kicks handling little children. After the day on the plate shop roof, Andy went his way, and the sisters went theirs. He was working in the library then, under a tough old con named Brooks Hatlin. Hatlin had gotten the job back in the late 20s because he had a college education. Brooksy's degree was in animal husbandry, true enough, but college educations in institutes of lower learning like the Shank are so rare that it's a case of beggars not being able to be choosers. In 1952, Brooksy, who had killed his wife and daughter after losing his streak at poker back when Coolidge was president, was paroled. As usual, the state, in all its wisdom, had let him go long after any chance he might have had to become a useful part of society was gone. He was 68 and arthritic when he tottered out of the main gate in his Polish suit and his French shoes, his parole papers in one hand and a Greyhound bus ticket in the other. He was crying when he left. Shawshank was his world. What lay beyond its walls was as terrible to Brooks as the Western Seas had been to superstitious 15th-century sailors. In prison, Brooksy had been a person of some importance. He was a librarian, an educated man. If he went to the Kittery Library and asked for a job, they wouldn't even give him a library card. I heard he died in a home for indigent old folks up Freeport Way in 1953, and at that he lasted about 6 months longer than I thought he would. Yeah, I guess the state got its own back on Brooksy, all right. They trained him to like it inside the shithouse, and then they threw him out. Andy succeeded to Brooksy's job, and he was librarian for 23 years. He used the same force of will I'd seen him use on Byron Hadley to get what he wanted for the library, and I gradually saw him turn one small room, which still smelled of turpentine because it had been a paint closet until 1922 and had never been properly aired, lined with Reader's Digest, condensed books, and National Geographics, into the best prison library in New England. He did it a step at a time. He put a suggestion box by the door and patiently weeded out such attempts at humor as "More Fook Books, Please," and "Escape in 10 Easy Lesions." He got hold of the things the prisoners seemed serious about. He wrote to the major book clubs in New York and got 2 of them, the Literary Guild and the Book of the Month Club, to send editions of all their major selections to us at a special cheap rate. He discovered a hunger for information on such small hobbies as soap carving, woodworking, sleight of hand, and card solitaire. He got all the books he could on such subjects, and those 2 jailhouse staples, Earl Stanley Gardner and Louis L'Amour. Cons never seemed to get enough of the courtroom or the open range. And yes, he did keep a box of fairly spicy paperbacks under the checkout desk, loaning them out carefully and making sure they always got back. Even so, each new acquisition of that type was quickly read to tatters. He began to write to the State Senate in Augusta in 1954. Stamos was warden by then, and he used to pretend Andy was some sort of mascot. He was always in the library, shooting the bull with Andy, and sometimes he'd even throw a paternal arm around Andy's shoulders or give him a goose. He didn't fool anybody. Andy Dufresne was no one's mascot. He told Andy that maybe he'd been a banker on the outside, but that part of his life was receding rapidly into his past, and he'd better get a hold on the facts of prison life. As far as that bunch of jumped-up Republican Rotarians in Augusta was concerned, there were only three viable expenditures of the taxpayers' money in the field of prisons and corrections. Number one was more walls, number two was more bars, and number three was more guards. As far as the State Senate was concerned, Stamos explained, the folks in Thomaston and Shawshank and Pittsfield and South Portland were the scum of the earth. They were there to do hard time, and by God and sonny Jesus, it was hard time they were going to do. And if there were a few weevils in the bread, wasn't that just too fucking bad? Andy smiled his small, composed smile and asked Stamos what would happen to a block of concrete if a drop of water fell on it once every year for 1,000,000 years. Stamos laughed and clapped Andy on the back. You got no 1,000,000 years, old horse, but if you did, I believe you'd do it with that same little grin on your face. You go on and write your letters. I'll even mail them for you if you pay for the stamps. Which Andy did. And he had the last laugh, although Stamos and Handley weren't around to see it. Andy's request for library funds were routinely turned down until 1960, when he received a check for $200. The Senate probably appropriated it in hopes that he would shut up and go away. Vain hope. Andy felt that he had finally gotten one foot in the door, and he simply redoubled his efforts. Two letters a week instead of one. In 1962, he got $400, and for the rest of the decade, the library received $700 a year, like clockwork. By 1971, that had risen to an even thousand. Not much, stacked up against what your average small-town library receives, I guess, but $1,000 can buy a lot of recycled Perry Mason stories and Jake Logan westerns. By the time Andy left, you could go into the library, expanded from its original paint locker to three rooms, and find just about anything you'd want. And if you couldn't find it, chances were good that Andy could get it for you. Now, you're asking yourself if all this came about just because Andy told Byron Hadley how to save the taxes on his windfall inheritance. The answer is yes and no. You can probably figure out what happened for yourself. Word got around that Shawshank was housing its very own pet financial wizard. In the late spring and the summer of 1950, Andy set up two trust funds for guards who wanted to assure a college education for their kids. He advised a couple of others who wanted to take small flyers in common stock, and they did pretty damn well, as things turned out. One of them did so well he was able to take an early retirement 2 years later. And I'll be damned if he didn't advise the warden himself, old Lemon Lips George Dunahy, on how to go about setting up a tax shelter for himself. That was just before Dunahy got the bum's rush, and I believe he must have been dreaming about all the millions his book was going to make him. By April of 1951, Andy was doing the tax returns for half the screws at Shawshank, and by 1952 he was doing almost all of them. He was paid in what may be a prison's most valuable coin, simple goodwill. Later on, after Greg Stamos took over the warden's office, Andy became even more important. But if I tried to tell you the specifics of just how, I'd be guessing. There are some things I know about and others I can only guess at. I know that there were some prisoners who received all sorts of special considerations, radios in their cells, extraordinary visiting privileges, things like that. And there were people on the outside who were paying for them to have those privileges. Such people are known as angels by the prisoners. All at once some fellow would be excused from working in the plate shop on Saturday forenoons, and you'd know that fellow had an angel out there who'd coughed up a chunk of dough to make sure it happened. The way it usually works is that the angel will pay the bribe to some middle-level screw, and the screw will spread the grease both up and down the administrative ladder. Then there was the discount auto repair service that laid Warden Donaghy low. It went underground for a while and then emerged stronger than ever in the late 50s, and some of the contractors that worked at the prison from time to time were paying kickbacks to the top administration officials, I'm pretty sure, and the same was almost certainly true of the companies whose equipment was bought and installed in the laundry and the license plate shop and the stamping mill that was built in 1963. By the late 60s, there was also a booming trade in pills, and the same administrative crowd was involved in turning a buck on that. All of it added up to a pretty good-sized river of illicit income, not like the pile of clandestine bucks that must fly around a really big prison like Attica or San Quentin, but not peanuts either. And money itself becomes a problem after a while. You can't just stuff it into your wallet and then shell out a bunch of crumpled 20s and dog-eared 10s when you want a pool built in your backyard or an addition put on your house. Once you get past a certain point, you have to explain where that money came from. And if your explanations aren't convincing enough, you're apt to wind up wearing a number yourself. So there was a need for Andy's services. They took him out of the laundry and installed him in the library. But if you wanted to look at it another way, they never took him out of the laundry at all. They just set him to work washing dirty money instead of dirty sheets. He funneled it into stocks, bonds, tax-free municipals, you name it. He told me once, about 10 years after that day on the plate shop roof, that his feelings about what he was doing were pretty clear, and that his conscience was relatively untroubled. The rackets would have gone on with him or without him. He had not asked to be sent to Shawshank, he went on. He was an innocent man who had been victimized by colossal bad luck, not a missionary or a do-gooder. Besides, Red, he told me with that same half-grin, what I'm doing in here isn't all that different from what I was doing outside. I'll hand you a pretty cynical axiom. The amount of expert financial help an individual or company needs rises in direct proportion to how many people that person or business is screwing. The people who run this place are stupid, brutal monsters, for the most part. The people who run the straight world are brutal and monstrous, but they happen not to be quite as stupid, because the standard of competence out there is a little higher. Not much, but a little. But the pills, I said. I don't want to tell you your business, but they make me nervous. Reds, uppers, downers, nembutols. Now they've got these things they call phase fours. I won't get anything like that. Never have. No, Andy said. I don't like the pills either. Never have. But I'm not much of a one for cigarettes or booze either, but I don't push the pills. I don't bring them in, and I don't sell them once they are in. Mostly it's the screws who do that. But, I know there's a fine line there. What it comes down to, Red, is some people refuse to get their hands dirty at all. That's called sainthood, and the pigeons land on your shoulders and crap all over your shirt. The other extreme is to take a bath in the dirt and deal any goddamn thing that will turn a dollar. Guns, switchblades, Big H, what the hell? You ever have a con come up to you and offer you a contract? I nodded. It's happened a lot of times over the years. You are, after all, the man who can get it, and they figure if you can get them batteries for their transistor radios or cartons of Luckies or lids of reefer, you can put them in touch with a guy who'll use a knife. Sure you have, Andy agreed, but you don't do it. Because guys like us, Red, we know there's a third choice. An alternative to staying Simon pure or bathing in the filth and the slime. It's the alternative that grown-ups all over the world pick. You balance off your walk through the hog wallow against what it gains you. You choose the lesser of two evils and try to keep your good intentions in front of you. And I guess you judge how well you're doing by how well you sleep at night and what your dreams are like. Good intentions, I said, and laughed. I know all about that, Andy. A fella can toddle right off to hell on that road. Don't you believe it, he said, growing somber. This is hell. Right here in the shank. They sell pills, and I tell them what to do with the money. But I've also got the library, and I know of over 24 guys who have used the books in there to help them pass their high school equivalency tests. Maybe when they get out of here, they'll be able to crawl off the shit heap. When we needed that second room back in 1957, I got it, because they want to keep me happy. I work cheap. That's the trade-off. And you've got your own private quarters.
Sure. That's the way I like it.
The prison population had risen slowly all through the 50s, and it damn near exploded in the 60s, what with every college-age kid in America wanting to try dope and the perfectly ridiculous penalties for the use of a little reefer. But in all that time, Andy never had a cellmate, except for a big, silent Indian named Normadan. Like all the Indians in the shank, he was called Chief, and Normadan didn't last long. A lot of the other long-timers thought Andy was crazy, but Andy just smiled. He lived alone, and he liked it that way. And as he'd said, they liked to keep him happy. He worked cheap. Prison time is slow time. Sometimes you'd swear it's stop time, but it passes, it passes. George Donaghy departed the scene in a welter of newspaper headlines shouting scandal and nest-feathering. Stamos succeeded him, and for the next 6 years, Shawshank was a kind of living hell. During the reign of Greg Stamos, the beds in the infirmary and the cells in the solitary wing were always full. One day in 1958, I looked at myself in a small shaving mirror I kept in my cell and saw a 40-year-old man looking back at me. A kid had come in back in 1938. A kid with a big mop of carroty red hair, half crazy with remorse, thinking about suicide. That kid was gone. The red hair was going gray and starting to recede. There were crow's tracks around the eyes. On that day, I could see an old man inside, waiting his time to come out. It scared me. Nobody wants to grow old in stir. Stamos went early in 1959. There had been several investigative reporters sniffing around, and one of them even did 4 months under an assumed name for a crime made up out of whole cloth. They were getting ready to drag out scandal and nest-feathering again, but before they could bring the hammer down on him, Stamos ran. I can understand that, boy, can I ever. If he had been tried and convicted, he could have ended up right in here. If so, he might have lasted all of 5 hours. Byron Hadley had gone 2 years earlier. The sucker had a heart attack and took an early retirement. Andy never got touched by the Stamos affair. In early 1959, a new warden was appointed, and a new assistant warden, and a new chief of guards. For the next 8 months or so, Andy was just another con again. It was during that period that Normadan, the big half-breed Passamaquoddies, shared Andy's cell with him. Then everything just started up again. Normadan was moved out, and Andy was living in solitary splendor again. The names at the top change, but the rackets never do. I talked to Normadan once about Andy. Nice fella, Normadan said. Was hard to make out anything, he said, because he had a hair lip and a cleft palate. All his words came out in a slush. I liked it there. He never made fun. But he didn't want me there. I could tell. Big shrug. I was glad to go, me. Bad draft in that cell, all the time cold. He don't let nobody touch his things. That's okay. Nice man. Never made fun. But big draft. Rita Hayworth hung in Andy's cell until 1955, if I remember right. Then it was Marilyn Monroe. That picture from the 7-year itch, where she's standing over a subway grating and the warm air is flipping her skirt up. Marilyn lasted until 1960, and she was considerably tattered about the edges when Andy replaced her with Jane Mansfield. Jane was, you should pardon the expression, a bust. After only a year or so, she was replaced with an English actress. Might have been Hazel Court, but I'm not sure. In 1966, that one came down, and Raquel Welch went up for a record-breaking 6-year engagement in Andy's cell. The last poster to hang there was a pretty country rock singer whose name was Linda Ronstadt. I asked him once what the posters meant to him, and he gave me a peculiar, surprised sort of look. Why, they mean the same thing to me as they do to most cons, I guess, he said. Freedom. You look at those pretty women and you feel like you could almost, not quite, but almost, step right through and be beside them. Be free. I guess that's why I always liked Raquel Welch the best. It wasn't just her, it was that beach she was standing on.
Looked like she was down in Mexico somewhere, someplace quiet where a man would be able to hear himself think. Did you ever feel that way about a picture, Red? That you could almost step right through it? I said I'd never really thought of it that way. Maybe someday you'll see what I mean, he said. And he was right. Years later, I saw exactly what he meant. And when I did, the first thing I thought of was Normandin, and about how he'd said it was always cold in Andy's cell. A terrible thing happened to Andy in late March or early April of 1963. I have told you that he had something that most of the other prisoners, myself included, seemed to lack. Call it a sense of equanimity, or a feeling of inner peace, maybe even a constant and unwavering faith that someday the long nightmare would end. Whatever you want to call it, Andy Dufresne always seemed to have his act together. There was none of that sullen desperation about him that seems to afflict most lifers after a while. You could never smell hopelessness on him. Until that late winter of 63. We had another warden by then, a man named Samuel Norton. The Mathers, Cotton, and Increase would have felt right at home with Sam Norton. So far as I know, no one had ever seen him so much as crack a smile. He had a 30-year pin from the Baptist Advent Church of Elliott. His major innovation as the head of our happy family was to make sure that each incoming prisoner had a New Testament. He had a small plaque on his desk, gold letters inlaid in teak wood, which said, "Christ is my Savior." A sampler on the wall made by his wife read, "His judgment cometh, and that right early." This latter sentiment cut zero ice with most of us. We felt that the judgment had already occurred, and we would be willing to testify with the best of them that the rock would not hide us, nor the dead tree give us shelter. He had a Bible quote for every occasion, did Mr. Sam Norton. And whenever you meet a man like that, my best advice to you would be to grin big and cover up your balls with both hands. There were less infirmary cases than in the days of Greg Stamos, and so far as I know, the moonlight burials ceased altogether, but this is not to say that Norton was not a believer in punishment. Solitary was always well populated. Men lost their teeth not from beatings, but from bread and water diets. It began to be called grain and drain, as in, "I'm on the Sam Norton grain and drain train, boys." The man was the foulest hypocrite that I ever saw in high position. The rackets I told you about earlier continued to flourish, but Sam Norton added his own new wrinkles. And he knew about them all, and because we had gotten to be pretty good friends by that time, he let me in on some of them. When Andy talked about them, an expression of amused, disgusted wonder would come over his face, as if he were telling me about some ugly, predatory species of bug that was, by its very ugliness and greed, somehow more comic than terrible. It was Warden Norton who instituted the Inside Out program. You may have read about it some 16 or 17 years back. It was even written up in Newsweek. In the press, it sounded like a real advance in practical corrections and rehabilitation. There were prisoners out cutting pulpwood, prisoners repairing bridges and causeways, prisoners constructing potato cellars. Norton called it Inside Out, and was invited to explain it to damn near every Rotary and Kiwanis club in New England, especially after he got his picture in Newsweek. The prisoners called it road ganging. And so far as I know, none of them were ever invited to express their views to the Kiwanians or the Loyal Order of Moose. Norton was right in there, on every operation, 30-year church pin and all. From cutting pulp to digging storm drains to laying new culverts under state highways, there was Norton, skimming off the top. There were 100 ways to do it. Men, materials, you name it. But he had it coming another way as well. The construction businesses in the area were deathly afraid of Norton's inside-out program because prison labor is slave labor, and you can't compete with that. So Sam Norton, he of the testaments and the 30-year church pin, was passed a good many thick envelopes under the table during his 16-year tenure as Shawshank's warden. And when an envelope was passed, he would either overbid the project, not bid at all, or claim that all his inside-outers were committed elsewhere. It has always been something of a wonder to me that Norton was never found in the trunk of a Thunderbird parked off a highway somewhere down in Massachusetts, with his hands tied behind his back and half a dozen bullets in his head. Anyway, as the old Barrel House song says, my God, how the money rolled in. Norton must have subscribed to the old Puritan notion that the best way to figure out which folks God favors is by checking their bank accounts. Andy Dufresne was his right hand in all of this, his silent partner. The prison library was Andy's hostage to fortune. Norton knew it, and Norton used it. Andy told me that one of Norton's favorite aphorisms was, one hand washes the other. So Andy gave good advice and made useful suggestions. I can't say for sure that he hand-tooled Norton's inside-out program, but I'm damn sure he processed the money for the Jesus-shouting son of a whore. He gave good advice, made useful suggestions. The money got spread around, and son of a bitch, the library would get a new set of automotive repair manuals, a fresh set of Grolier encyclopedias, books on how to prepare for the scholastic achievement tests, and, of course, more Earl Stanley Gardners and more Louis L'Amours. And I'm convinced that what happened, happened because Norton just didn't want to lose his good right hand. I'll go further. It happened because he was scared of what might happen, what Andy might say against him if Andy ever got clear of Shawshank State Prison. I got the story a chunk here and a chunk there over a space of 7 years, some of it from Andy, but not all. He never wanted to talk about that part of his life, and I don't blame him. I got parts of it from maybe half a dozen different sources. I've said once that prisoners are nothing but slaves, but they have that slave habit of looking dumb and keeping their ears open. I got it backwards and forwards and in the middle, but I'll give it to you from point A to point Z, and maybe you'll understand why the man spent about 10 months in a bleak, depressed daze. See, I don't think he knew the truth until 1963, 15 years after he came into this sweet little hellhole. Until he met Tommy Williams, I don't think he knew how bad it could get. Tommy Williams joined our happy little Shawshank family in November of 1962. Tommy thought of himself as a native of Massachusetts, but he wasn't proud. In his 27 years, he'd done time all over New England. He was a professional thief, and as you may have guessed, my own feeling was that he should have picked another profession. He was a married man, and his wife came to visit each and every week. She had an idea that things might go better with Tommy, and consequently better with their 3-year-old son and herself, if he got his high school degree. She talked him into it, and so Tommy Williams started visiting the library on a regular basis. For Andy, this was an old routine by then. He saw that Tommy got a series of high school equivalency tests. Tommy would brush up on the subjects he had passed in high school, there weren't many, and then take the test. Andy also saw that he was enrolled in a number of correspondence courses covering the subjects he had failed in school or just missed by dropping out. He probably wasn't the best student Andy ever took over the jumps, and I don't know if he ever did get his high school diploma, but that forms no part of my story. The important thing was that he came to like Andy Dufresne very much, as most people did after a while. On a couple of occasions, he asked Andy, what a smart guy like you is doing in the joint? A question which is the rough equivalent of one that goes, what's a nice girl like you doing in a place like this? But Andy wasn't the type to tell him. He would only smile and turn the conversation into some other channel. Quite normally, Tommy asked someone else, and when he finally got the story, I guess he also got the shock of his young life. The person he asked was his partner on the laundry's steam ironer and folder. The inmates call this device the mangler because that's exactly what it'll do to you if you aren't paying attention and get your bad self caught in it. His partner was Charlie Lathrop, who had been in for about 12 years on a murder charge. He was more than glad to reheat the details of the Dufresne murder trial for Tommy. It broke the monotony of pulling freshly pressed bedsheets out of the machine and tucking them into the basket. He was just getting to the jury, waiting until after lunch to bring in their guilty verdict, when the trouble whistle went off and the mangle grated to a stop. They had been feeding in freshly washed sheets from the Elliott nursing home at the far end. These were spat out dry and neatly pressed at Tommy's and Charlie's end at the rate of 1 every 5 seconds. Their job was to grab them, fold them, and slap them into the cart, which had already been lined with clean brown paper. But Tommy Williams was just standing there, staring at Charlie Lathrop, his mouth unhinged all the way to his chest. He was standing in a drift of sheets that had come through clean and which were now sopping up all the wet muck on the floor. And in a laundry wet wash, there's plenty of muck. So the head bull that day, Homer Jessup, comes rushing over, bellowing his head off and on the prod for trouble. Tommy took no notice of him. He spoke to Charlie as if old Homer, who had busted more heads than he could probably count, hadn't been there. "What did you say that golf pro's name was?" "Quentin," Charlie answered back, all confused and upset by now. He later said that the kid was white as a truce flag. "Glenn Quentin, I think, something like that anyway." Here now," Homer Jessup roared, his neck as red as a rooster's comb. "Get them sheets in cold water. Get quick, by Jesus, you—" "Glenn Quentin. Oh, my God," Tommy Williams said, and that was all he got to say because Homer Jessup, that least peaceable of men, brought his billy down behind his ear. Tommy hit the floor so hard he broke off three of his front teeth. When he woke up, he was in solitary and confined to same for a week, riding a boxcar on Sam Norton's famous grain and drain train, plus a black mark on his report card. That was in early February of 1963, and Tommy Williams went around to six or seven other long-timers after he got out of solitary and got pretty much the same story. I know I was one of them. But when I asked him why he wanted it, he just clammed up. Then one day he went to the library and spilled one hell of a big budget of information to Andy Dufresne. And for the first and last time, at least since he had approached me about the Rita Hayworth poster like a kid buying his first pack of Trojans, Andy lost his cool. Only this time, he blew it entirely. I saw him later that day, and he looked like a man who had stepped on the business end of a rake and given himself a good one, whap, between the eyes. His hands were trembling, and when I spoke to him, he didn't answer. Before that afternoon was out, he had caught up with Billy Hanlon, who was the head screw, and set up an appointment with Warden Norton for the following day. He told me later that he didn't sleep a wink all that night. He just listened to a cold winter wind howling outside, watched the searchlights go around and around, putting long, moving shadows on the cement walls of the cage he had called home since Harry Truman was president, and tried to think it all out. He said it was as if Tommy had produced a key which fit a cage in the back of his mind, a cage like his own cell. Only instead of holding a man, that cage held a tiger, and that tiger's name was Hope. Williams had produced the key that unlocked the cage, and the tiger was out, willy-nilly, to roam his brain. 4 years before, Tommy Williams had been arrested in Rhode Island, driving a stolen car that was full of stolen merchandise. Tommy turned in his accomplice, the DA played ball, and he got a lighter sentence, 2 to 4 with time served. 11 months after beginning his term, his old cellmate got a ticket out, and Tommy got a new one, a man named Elwood Blatch. Blatch had been busted for burglary with a weapon and was serving 6 to 12. "I've never seen such a high-strung guy," Tommy told me. "A man like that should never want to be a burglar, especially not with a gun. The slightest little noise, he'd go 3 feet into the air and come down shooting, more likely than not. One night he almost strangled me because some guy down the hall was whopping on his cell bars with a tin cup. I did 7 months with him until they let me walk free. I got time served and time off, you understand. I can't say we talked because you didn't, you know, exactly hold a conversation with L. Blatch. He held a conversation with you. He talked all the time, never shut up. If you tried to get a word in, he'd shake his fist at you and roll his eyes. It gave me the cold chills whenever he done that. Big, tall guy he was, mostly bald, with these green eyes set way down deep in the sockets. Jeez, I hope I never see him again. It was like a talking jag every night. Where he grew up, the orphanages he'd run away from, the jobs he'd done, the women he'd fucked, the crap games he'd cleaned out. I just let him run on. My face ain't much, but I didn't want it, you know, rearranged for me. According to him, he'd burgled over 200 joints. It was hard for me to believe a guy like him who went off like a firecracker every time someone cut a loud fart, but he swore it was true. Now, listen to me, Red, I know guys sometimes make things up after they know a thing, but even before I knew about this golf pro guy, Quentin, I remember thinking that if Al Blatch ever burgled my house and I found out about it later, I'd have to count myself just about the luckiest motherfucker going still to be alive. Can you imagine him in some lady's bedroom sifting through her jewelry box and she coughs in her sleep or turns over quick? Gives me the cold chills just to think of something like that. I swear on my mother's name it does. He said he'd killed people, too. People that gave him shit. At least that's what he said. And I believed him. He sure looked like a man who could do some killing. He was just so fucking high-strung, like a pistol with a sawed-off firing pin. I knew a guy who had a Smith & Wesson police special with a sawed-off firing pin. It wasn't no